All right, thanks for hanging on for yet another strange crop. So first of all, I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to come and talk about kiwis and present what I'm thinking about quite a lot at the University of New Hampshire. I'm an assistant professor there of specialty crop improvement. I've only been there about 3.5 years, and so my hardy kiwis went into the ground in 2013. And I'm just now, this year, seeing my first fruit. So a lot of what I'm going to show you is really based on the work of a lot of other people before me. And then I'm going to share with you some of the questions I'm sort of struggling with right now and that sort of thing. So, cold hardy kiwis. First of all, my work is being supported largely by the New Hampshire Agricultural Experiment Station. So I'm working in our McFarland greenhouses, and we have a horticultural research farm there. And I have about an acre and a half experimental vineyard, where I'm doing my work. And before I launch into the crop itself, I really want to pull my acknowledgments up front here. The picture you see on the left, this is Bob Guthrie. He's at the Horticultural Research Center at the University of Minnesota. He's a quote-unquote volunteer curator of the Actinidia collection there, but has been working there for several decades now, and he has just been so generous with his time, with the germplasm that he has amassed at the University of Minnesota and the lessons he's learned over the years, so I really want to highlight him. But in addition to that, there are a lot of growers, nurserymen, and really pioneers of the hardy kiwi that I'm kind of standing on their shoulders at this point. Tom Vigu in Maine, part of the Fedco cooperative growers there. Dave Jackson in Pennsylvania has 20 acres under trellis and was really quite a pioneer bringing this into commercial production. And then you have folks like Mark Fulford and Jim Gilbert and Bob Glansman, who over the last few decades have traveled all over the world and brought a lot of the germplasm into North America. So we owe a lot to them. In terms of researchers, USDA, repository curators, Bernadine Strick, Kathy Dimchak. So I just want to pull this up front because I feel it's funny to be brought in as a, to talk about kiwi as though I'm an expert, and I feel like I'm really learning so much from folks who've been working on this crop a lot longer than I have. So in the next 20 minutes, what I'd like to do is to describe the species for you, if you're not familiar, with them, and why I think they have such potential as a commercial crop. And then the flip side of that is, if they are so great, and the fact that they've been in North America for about 150 years, why aren't they already a widely grown commercial crop? And some of my thoughts on that. I'll then get into cultivation and production practices, and then touch very briefly at the end about my own program, the breeding program itself, but also some of the pre-breeding work and supporting research that I'm undertaking, and then finish off with what available resources are currently available. So cold hardy kiwi, what they are not are the fuzzy kiwis you know and love in the store. The fuzzy kiwis, these are temperate kiwis, and they are Actinidia deliciosa and Actinidia chinensis, although now that's sort of been lumped together into Actinidia chinensis with varieties deliciosa and chinensis. These kiwis here make up 99%+ of the global market, and the Hayward variety, until very recently, was 95% or more of the global market. There's been a shift recently in the industry toward the Actinidia chinensis because there's more color variation, and you will start to see this variety, Hort 16A, it goes under the commercial name of Zespri Gold. You start seeing that in the stores now. But that species is only one of a rather diverse genus. Within Actinidia, there's 54 species. They have a very wide distribution through mainly the center of origin and provenance is China. But as you can see here, you get some sense of the variation among these 54 species, from the very, very hairy, hairy ones that you wouldn't want to get anywhere near, to completely hairless ones. A lot of variation in terms of color, flavor, fruit size, fruit shape, and so on. And you can get a sense of that here as well. So in addition to the green kiwi that you may be familiar with, we have deep purples, deep reds, Blues are other people. So it's very exciting from a breeding standpoint to have access to this wide variation, and there's great ability to hybridize and create interspecific hybrids within the genus as well. So from a breeding standpoint, it's a really exciting genus to work within. I'm going to be talking about mainly Actinidia arguta. This is the Actinidia species with the widest geographical distribution. And just to give you a comparison to Actinidia deliciosa, this is the Hayward variety. Actinidia deliciosa as a species has fruit size ranging from 30 to 200 grams, whereas Actinidia arguta is on the smaller size, 4 to 20 grams, with most of the fruits around the 5 to 7 gram size. So we're talking like grape-sized fruits, and unlike the Hayward variety or deliciosa, these are hairless. The skins are very tender, they're very palatable, so you would just pop them in your mouth like you would a grape. And so that's part of what makes, it's part of the excitement around this fruit is how convenient it is to eat. Within the Actinidia genus, there are three considered cold hardy species, of which Actinidia arguta is one of them. And that is Actinidia colomicta, which is the most cold hardy, Actinidia arguta, which has the largest geographic range, and then Actinidia polygama. And roughly what you see here is the region of provenance or center of origin of these three species. So we're talking central China through northern China into southern Siberia, northern Japan, and North Korea. Actinidia arguta is across this entire range. The colomictas are a little bit more in the northern tier, and the polygama is more in the southern tier. And they go by a lot of different names. Wild fig, Siberian gooseberry, bower vine, tara vine. And I think part of the issue moving forward with this species and a lot of these novel species is trying to coalesce around a single market name or a market presence. And where it looks like it's heading is toward kiwiberry. And part of that's because New Zealand has sort of put a flag in the ground and call their arguta varieties that they've released New Zealand kiwiberry. And I know Dave Jackson in Pennsylvania, who's the largest single arguta grower in the U.S., that's also the name he's really adopted. And so I think that's probably going to be the way forward with these. So in terms of kind of primitive features, all the Actinidia are very vigorous perennial woody vines. And so they will twirl and twine and grow up anything that's near them, as you can see here. So a plant left to its own accord has a really wild habit about it. This is a picture I took at Triple Brook Farm. This is Steve Breyer, who's been growing hardy kiwis in Massachusetts for many, many decades. This is his mother plant, this one big plant here, variety Geneva 3. So when he makes, propagates this plant for his nursery, he just goes out to this enormous plant and takes cuttings. So you can see grapes up in there. And so these vines will really just take off on you. And this is part of the reason why this was part of the appeal when they were originally brought to North America in the 1870s. They were originally picked up by nurseries mainly along in New England and along the eastern seaboard as an ornamental vine. And so you have some very well-known names in landscape design, Olmsted, some of Olmsted's contemporaries like Beatrix Ferrand, used Actinidia very heavily as what they called a utility vine. And so the biggest estates of that time, botanical gardens, had Actinidia all over the place. And they were used to cover buildings and kind of soften the sharp lines of buildings and the landscape, and they were quite beautiful. And when you add to that some of the other ornamental characteristics, so this is a typical plant of Actinidia colomicta, the more cold hardy species, and it has a very interesting feature that during the time of anthesis, the flowers are sort of poised underneath the leaves, and during anthesis, the leaves will take on this white color that then become very, very rosy. You get this beautiful flush of color around anthesis. Here's a little bit better picture of that. So it's this climbing quality, the fact that it could quickly cover your cottage In addition to some of these leaf characteristics, the petioles of Actinidia arguta, you can have really cherry red petioles, which are quite beautiful, but there's variation here. You can see a green petiole genotype here right beside the red petiole. So the early period of the cold hardy kiwis in the U.S. was around its ornamental quality, and it wasn't until later in you know, 20s, 30s that people realized that the fruit is actually quite wonderful as well. All the Actinidia species, and the cold hardy species are no exception, are functionally dioecious, and so you have your female plants and your male plants, but I guess like with people, gender is a spectrum with the Actinidia. I've read in some of the early publications that there are really seven genders within Actinidia. You have the true males, the true females, you have the fruiting males, you have the hermaphroditic plants, and so it seems to be all over the place. There's reports in the literature of some plants being self-fertile. I've certainly seen fruit set on plants when there was no pollinator around, but that fruit usually is a little bit misshapen, it's smaller. And so in general, if you have folks coming to you who are interested in planting cold hardy kiwi, you really should plant both male and female plants. You know, whereas you may get some fruit, you'll certainly get much better fruit set and more uniform fruit set with both. And part of there's been a lot of interest in the cold hardy kiwi for a long time, but as I've started this work, I run into growers in New England who, you know, have plants they've planted in their yard for the last 20 years, and they say, "Well, I've never really gotten fruit. I don't know what I'm doing wrong." But this idea that it's dioecious is really critical, and it's a little misleading because if you look at the females, they look like perfect flowers, but it's just the pollen is not viable, and so it seems like you're working with a perfect flower, but you're really not getting fruit set. A little bit on the ploidy. We have a large variation in ploidy with the hardy kiwis, from diploids up to octoploids. And sorting out the ploidy is one of the things I hope to be doing up front. There's been some work done in Minnesota where the vast majority of the arguta lines tested were diploids, but the higher levels of ploidy are certainly known. And it's an interesting tidbit that the great David Fairchild, you know, the great plant explorer in the early 19th century, he had a real soft spot in his heart for the Actinidia, and you know, his seminal paper early on about the fascination of making a plant hybrid was really around Actinidia, and that was around his Actinidia Fairchildi, which was a fertile cross between Arguta and Deliciosa. So that's a little bit of background of the plant we're talking about. Why I think, and others for a long time now, over 100 years, have really thought that there's great potential with these species. First and foremost for me is the taste. I first ran into this fruit and this species when I was a grad student at UC Davis, where there's some plantings there. And if you've eaten these kiwis, it's really hard to go back to the big kiwi in the store. The Brix levels are much, much higher. They have a really nice complex flavor, acid, some real hints of tropical flavors, especially in the Colomictas, you know, kind of pineapple flavors, mango. And so it's really wonderful. And then of course, as you can see here, I've tried, since I can't pass out a bunch of fruit, if you could taste it, try to find the most luscious pictures I could find of these things. You know, aesthetically, they're very, very appealing as well. In addition to them, they're tasting quite wonderful. They also have been touted as a superfood or a superfruit or a functional food. Largely, this is due to their very, very high levels of vitamin C. In China, the kiwi is called the king of the fruit because of its high levels of vitamin C. And within Actinidia, that can be anywhere between 80 and 430 milligrams per 100 grams of fresh weight. So we're talking extremely high levels of vitamin C, as I found in literature. And unlike Eric, I haven't run these tests myself on the germplasm, but this seems to be corroborated by a lot of research groups in China and New Zealand as well. So In addition to that, it's a very good source of potassium, vitamin E, a lot of vitamins, calcium, magnesium, iron, carotenoids, and so I think this is another, you know, as we look toward the market potential of this fruit, this is certainly an aspect that is very promising. For folks like me up in New England, New Hampshire, the other very appealing characteristic of these species are their cold hardiness. So Actinidia arguta, if the plant has fully gone into dormancy, can withstand temperatures down to negative 25 Fahrenheit. Colomicta, even more hardy than that, down to negative 40. And I should say, this is if the plant is probably not in its first year, and if it is fully dormant. Plants out in the field for the first year are a little more susceptible to this. And even though the plants themselves can withstand these temperatures, the young shoots and the flowers cannot. And so, like a lot of the crops we've heard about this morning, late spring frost is a real issue with the kiwis. And I put here, so New Hampshire, we're zones 3 to 5, essentially, and that's right in the middle of northern China, which is an overlapping provenance of both arguta and colomicta. So this is, and they've grown for decades in Minnesota as well. So I think for those of us in northern climates where we really don't have a lot of options for unique high-value horticultural crops, there's a lot of excitement around the cold hardy kiwis. In addition to all of that, there's indication that there's true economic viability for these species. In the U.S., growers I've talked to who've been growing these for a couple decades, the kind of yields they're getting are anywhere between 7 and 12 tons per acre. And so these are high-yielding vines, and if you're growing them organically, some folks are getting as much as $12 a pound for these things, $8 a pound wholesale. Literature coming out of New Zealand are saying over 20 tons per acre in their production systems, which is kind of mind-boggling to me. And these are some fruits that are being shipped globally. So New Zealand actually exports cold hardy kiwi to about 7 other countries, the U.S. being one of them, and for a slightly lower price. And so just walking into this, you know, from a breeder's perspective, it seems to me that there's enough anecdotal evidence and enough experience in growers to make me think that there's real economic viability and potential for this crop. So as early as probably the 1890s, botanists and scientists had flagged the cold hardy kiwis as having a lot of commercial potential. And there was kind of waxing and waning interest from the breeding community for cold hardy kiwis over the 20th century, but for the most part, a lot of those efforts kind of petered out. We have some selections from those efforts. The selections that we have are usually maybe one or two generations away from purely wild plants, so there has not been a lot of systematic breeding done, even though we have some selections. And my take on what the obstacles really were being encountered by these breeding programs in the 20th century was, first of all, the small size of the fruits. And this is at the time when the temperate kiwi was trying to make its way and becoming more familiar in the 20th century, and so a lot of the cold hardy breeding programs were essentially trying to make the little ones as big as the fuzzy ones. And I think that you're just going to have no success doing that. So if that was a core breeding objective, you get frustrated very, very quickly. Another thing that sort of derailed breeding efforts was their poor storability, relative, again, I think, to the temperate kiwi, where the idea was if you're going to make a crop of any global importance, it needs to be able to store for 6 months. You got to be able to put it on boats and get it globally. And if you have something that only has a shelf life of a month and a half, and it's relatively softer, that kind of puts you out of the game in terms of this global commodity view of horticulture. And then the other thing, of course, kiwi now is a very familiar fruit across the U.S., but 20 years ago, even, it wasn't. And so I think there was a familiarity issue. Part of what I think, has changed, or it's not that the plant's biology has changed or the genetics have changed. What has really changed is their food culture. And this is particularly true in New England, where we have some of the highest per capita dollars spent on direct marketing, farmers markets. So this changing food culture, this idea of local, more interest in where the food is coming from and the quality of it has now turned small size into, you know, if you have a really high quality fruit that tastes really amazing and has nutritional quality, the size is less important now than maybe it used to be. Poor storage, I call that local. Right? You know, if you have a fruit that can store for a month and a half and you have a very robust direct marketing system in your region, that's not necessarily a problem. And we've really moved from the realm of unfamiliarity with kiwis. People are more familiar with them, and now that you have tiny little kiwis that you don't even have to peel, that becomes a novel feature rather than something that's quite unfamiliar. So I think we have opportunities now that even maybe 20 years ago we didn't really have. In terms of cultivation globally right now, the state of things is, so in China, for example, a lot of kiwis are still wild harvested. The last number I could get, so 2004, 183,000 tons of kiwi harvested from the wild. And so this is a fairly common sight within central China. Of that, over 20,000 tons of that was the Leocarpi. And so the cold hardy kiwis are part of that. In terms of non-wild actual commercial production, we are talking less than 400 acres globally. So it's just nothing at all. And existing U.S. commercial production is maybe around 120 acres. Like I said, 20 acres of that is this one operator in Pennsylvania, the only organic producer of hardy kiwis, and then most of the rest is in the Pacific Northwest, Hearst Berry Farm, the cooperative of growers there. Getting into production practices, the first thing I would like to point out is this manual, which is just excellent, developed by Bernadine Strick at OSU, came out I think in 2004, 2005 area. I can't recommend this more highly. It's really a wonderful resource, and a lot of what I'm going to be presenting to you here is actually from that manual. But in general, if growers who are interested in producing this or putting this into the ground, some of the site characteristics, you're looking at slightly acidic soils, 5.5 to 7. A lot of this, though, is based on New Zealand research on the temperate kiwis with the assumption that it also kind of holds for other Actinidia species. But the work in the Pacific Northwest and even in Minnesota tend to show that if you're within this range of around 6, 6.5, the plants seem to do quite well. Well-drained soils, they use a lot of water. These are very, very vigorous vines. A vine can put on 20 feet in a season easily. And at the peak of their growing, they're using a lot of water. So I would say if you have a grower who's interested in planting some hardy kiwis, irrigation is a must. You need to be able to get water. You need to get water on it when the natural rainfall is not sufficient. The big problems in production would be this late frost damage issue. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that. There are reports of verticillium wilt. I haven't seen that yet in my vines, but in Dr. Strick's experience, that is a case. She also cites root knot nematode, which I've not yet seen in my vineyard. And the other one to be in terms of citing considerations would be wind damage. And you can see here on this one fruit, I didn't have a great picture of this, the berries can rub and you get sort of a roughening of the skin. And so this is an overhead view of the farm in Pennsylvania, and this looks a lot like the kiwi vineyards in New Zealand. It's very, very typical. You'll see the trellised vines here, and they're always surrounded by a windbreak, either plantings or an artificial windbreak. But this is really key to either, if you're in a windy spot, to have these sort of shelters, or to site them such that you're not in a high wind area. And it's not just from a fruit quality issue, but also the vines can be prone to snapping and breaking and that sort of thing. And then in terms of the frost issue, siting is critical. You want to be in a place where a well-drained area so that the frost can drain away, or you have overhead irrigation that you can put on the vines if there does look to be a late spring frost event, or even using the fans that you see in Napa Valley. This is in Pennsylvania. He actually ends up installing a fan to help with air movement for that. In terms of training, these are heavy vines, and so I'm using a T-bar trellis system. You also see pergola systems like this. I'll move forward. And then the male to female ratio is usually about a 1-to-8, and you can think about this in terms of kind of 8 females around 1 male, and that modulus is sort of taken throughout the vineyard, and that seems to give good pollination. But that ratio can be anywhere from between 1-to-5 and 1-to-10. In terms of training, it's usually about 4 years to get a vine up into full production. The first year is really just letting the root system establish. The second year is training your trunk, letting one vigorous shoot go up the trunk. And what you can see here is it's going to want to twine. And this is kind of a season that takes a lot of manual labor of untwining this trunk, tying it, and getting a really straight trunk. Part of this is because of just the strength you're going to need to support all the weight down the road. But also, as these things grow and these vines live 20, 30 plus years, if they're really twining, they start you start getting some vascular issues that you really want to avoid. So getting a good straight trunk is quite important. In the third year, you start training your cordons along a center wire like this. And then you get into year four, this sort of training of laterals that you're tying down. These are going to be your fruiting branches. And so here you can see, I put this clip on. This is a New Zealand company that makes these horticultural ties that are just fantastic. I have a couple samples with me here. They've made my life much easier. But training down these laterals, and these are ties that would be good in grape systems as well and berry systems, so if you would like to see some, I can show you. And then you get into this system of every other year, basically the laterals that have fruited, those get pruned out and you replace them with the new laterals, and you're always getting fruit off of 1-year-old wood, as you can see here. So a mature vine, once it's set up, is going to look something like this. You have this big horizontal canopy where the fruit is hanging down below. If left, so that's in theory, you should be able to do that. But like I said, left to its own accord, you get something like this. This is in western Massachusetts. And this is, if you hear about concerns over invasiveness of kiwi, it's because of a site like this where you can have 3-4 acre amphitheaters tearing down forests. So that kind of thing certainly can happen. And in my own vineyard, I'm fighting this all the time. I'm trying to train, but I'm dealing with vines like this, and it feels like one of those puzzles that make you go crazy. So I'm really trying to work out what the best vine management practices are. But it can be done, as this picture from Pennsylvania shows. You really can have well-trained vines. In terms of fertility, not much. You know, a pound of N per mature vine. There's maintenance applications of phosphorus and potassium, with the note that kiwi vines have a high chlorine sensitivity, 5-to-toxicity to chlorine, so none of that fertilizer should have chlorine in it. And of course, maintaining the soil at pH 6. I show this. One of the big issues to consider is just having synchronous flowering. Once the flowers open, you have 5 days, maybe a week, to have pollination, so this selection of male and female vines that are in sync is very, very important. And as you can see here, it's that flowering, even though a given flower maybe will be receptive for a few days across the plant, the flowering can span maybe 2 weeks. Some growers have dispensed with male plants entirely and just buy big gallon jugs of pollen and then go through the vineyard and start spraying. And so you can get this, and part of the question I have is, economically, this may end up making more sense. You know, you basically get rid of all your male plants, your productivity goes up by a ninth because now you have all fruiting plants, and it would be very interesting to see the economics of that. Once you get your fruit, you can have some very nice looking clusters. I've seen, in general, people have picked individual fruits, but I see no reason why you couldn't just cut the cluster, and especially if you can get uniform ripening like this and uniform size, and we see selections that have this, so I think there's a lot of potential there. The fruits, some will be on these terminating spurs, but others will be on these long vines that don't really terminate. And so part of what I'm evaluating right now is this ratio of terminating versus non-terminating spurs. That'll help with vine management, but also could maybe open the door for this more cluster-based harvesting. I'm almost done. In terms of harvest, one problem is that the kiwis don't change color. They don't tell you when they're ready. And if they become soft, then you've missed the boat. And so harvesting is usually based on the refractometer reading. Around 10 bricks is when you'd want to harvest. And then these kiwis will then move all the way up to 20, 25 bricks. So very much like grapes. And this is one reason why winemakers are very excited about these species, because we can get sugar levels and complexity flavor profiles that are conducive to winemaking. In terms of post-harvest, 1.5 to 2 months if you hold them near zero or 32 degrees in an ethylene-free environment. And then once pulled out to room temperature, you're looking at 4 to 5 days before all the starch is cleared via hydrolysis. My own breeding goals, it's all the things you would imagine. I'm at this point evaluating germplasm, looking for higher, more uniform yields, quality, especially delayed dormancy of bud break because of the spring frost issue. This reduced vegetative vigor is a real issue in terms of invasiveness, but also vine management. Fruit adherence, this is one issue with the Colomyctas, is when the fruit becomes ripe, it'll just drop on the ground. So that's not very helpful, whereas the Argutas don't do that. But there are Colomycta varieties that don't do that. Clara Zeitkin is one, and it looks like that is a trait that's simply inherited. Where I am in my program right now, I'm trying to just get good diversity assessments. So I'm using genotyping by sequencing to get a handle on what our North American collection really looks like. I'm finding a lot of redundancy in the collection. I'm finding plants that are named the same thing but clearly aren't the same thing. And so I'm just trying to get a baseline of what we're dealing with, basically for parental selection. And I'm also working on some real simple marker development for sex determination at the seedling stage, because these plants are so big and they take so long to come into fruit, just to help with my own breeding efficiency and also pedestal adherence. But I know we're running out of time, so I'll wrap it up there. But anyone who is interested in hardy kiwis, I would love to talk with you. And in particular, if I'm still in the stage of trying to gather germplasm, we have a quarantine on North America. We cannot bring any more kiwi germplasm into North America because of bacterial blight issues in New Zealand. And so what we have is what we have to work with. So if you have leads about where these things are planted, I would love to talk with you about trying to increase the collection. And we come a long way from, you know, this was the journal for kiwi information in 1992, the Kiwi Fruit Enthusiast Journal, and now we've just had a world monograph come out in 2014. Bernadine Strick's extension publication is there. So I think things are really, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. And so thank you very much. Sorry to run over this.